You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 18th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, my friends. Rebecca, I missed you last week. Give me a hug.
Oh, I missed you, too.
Virtual hug.
Hug.
Group hug, everyone.
All right, get a room. But,
hey.
Chat room.
So happy summer solstice, everyone.
I laid an egg on its side today, and it stayed down.
It is the day when the tilt of the axis is most pointed toward the sun. At least the summer solstice for the northern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it's also known as the Northern Solstice, or the Solstice of Northern Aggression.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
It changes days depending on a number of factors. Well, mostly just the leap year. But yeah, this year it is today, June 21st. And because the axial tilt of the Earth is at its maximum towards the sun, that means that here in the Northern Hemisphere, we are currently enjoying our longest day and our shortest evening. And from here on out, our days will get more or less progressively shorter and shorter. And yeah, so a lot of holidays and stuff sprung up around the solstice, same as with the winter solstice, except for the summer solstice. They tend to be a bit more sex-oriented. Lots of sex stuff happens. Also, lots of burning things.
Burning Man.
Burning Man.
Yeah. Is that a solstice thing?
No, I don't think so. Didn't it happen last month?
I don't know. That's in July, but it's burning. It's hot.
It is. Thank you. It is burning.
Ouch.
Yeah, and it's traditional in many European, like Northern European cultures. It was at one point traditional to burn fires to keep away spirits and things like that. Every region has its different festivals and things. Seattle has the Fremont Summer Solstice Parade. Big fan of that. Lots of skin. So yeah, how are you guys celebrating the solstice?
By recording a podcast.
Oh, well, we're not recording on the day. This is coming out on the day. So right now, as the listener is listening, I am laying on a beach somewhere.
Yeah. I've just finished 6 hours of post-production.
I'm at a LARP.
Really? You're LARPing this weekend?
Yes, I am LARPing this weekend.
What a perfect weekend for a LARP.
Yeah, Friday night I'll be seeing George Robb's concert.
Oh, there you go.
A tribute to Sting.
Ah.
There are a lot of myths surrounding the summer solstice. Of course, the one that comes up every year, or the equinox, whichever one, is the whole standing the egg on its
head. I think that's usually the spring equinox.
Spring and fall, yes.
Some people think it's the hottest day of the year, but it's not.
Ah.
It's just the longest light.
Longest sunlight.
Yeah. There's a delay in the, you know, the heating up of the atmosphere, so the hottest day hits around beginning of August sometime. Typically.
Which makes sense if you think about it.
Yeah.
And all because of the axial tilt of the Earth.
Thank God for
things would be very different if we didn't have
gosh.
It.
We'd arguably not be here.
And fortunately the tilt is very stable, probably because of the moon.
Yes.
Well, guys, are you up to date on Cosmos? Did you guys see the last episode?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes, yes.
So we said we would come and revisit the Cosmos series after we saw the whole thing. So what'd you guys think?
Loved it.
I effing loved it. It was magnificent.
I enjoyed it more as the series went on. I thought it got better, especially, you know, towards the end. And the subject matter was just, you know, wonderful, spot on. The graphics just blows everything else away as far as I'm concerned with these kinds of shows. Spared no expense, obviously, and did a wonderful, wonderful job.
Notch.
And yeah, again, I felt more comfortable with Neil as the show progressed. I guess I had some hesitation in the beginning, or just getting a little bit used to him as far as playing the role of Carl Sagan. But by the end of it, I'm like, okay, this is Neil's Cosmos. And I had kind of no problem with it, no issues. I wasn't even really thinking about Carl Sagan that much at the very end, except when the very, very cool quote from Carl and the pale blue dot and that whole famous recite was done. And that was a beautiful, wonderful tribute. It really ended well. I enjoyed the whole series.
Evan, I felt similarly about Tyson in the beginning.
He did a great job throughout, but the first couple episodes, I was taken aback. I don't know if you guys sensed it or noticed it as well. It was this quirky delivery, something about the cadence or his facial expression, something about how he was delivering the lines just seemed a little odd. But then, after just a couple episodes, I think it was endearing and I really enjoyed that aspect of his delivery. I don't know if you guys noticed that as well, but, I thought he was fantastic in that role.
Well, I don't think it's uncommon for people that are shooting a TV series to slip into the zone. You know, it took him a while maybe to get comfortable, or, you know, there's a lot of times there's a lot of headbutting with the director and the producers and everything on how it's going to be, but he definitely did find that sweet spot. And, I'm just thrilled that the TV show is as popular as it is and was produced at the level that it was. And I'm just really hoping that other shows like this are going to now come into being because of this.
Well, what about, has there been any talk of like a Cosmos 2 doing another round of, you know, 8 or 10 episodes? I mean, there's still so much out there.
Yeah, clearly like a huge amount of work went into that. So,
oh my God.
I don't know if you would have even the time to do it again, you know?
I think it would be nice because, you know, the Cosmos is definitely an introduction into the big ideas of science for somebody who's not necessarily already, you know, a scientist or very scientifically literate. So it's good. Another season could go deeper, you know, could take it a little bit further. There's plenty of territory he didn't cover. You know what I mean?
You know what really makes me upset though is like, I love Cosmos. But having it on TV also gave me a stark reality check. Like, this is like the only really good science show on TV. You know, I know there's other science shows out there, but when you think of the vast majority of the crap that's out there, like the reality TV and everything else, like it's pretty much everything else is reality TV. We have like the nighttime TV shows and then daytime television, garbage, and then all the reality TV, garbage. And then there's this shining star of a science show and now it's over.
You could also just compare it to the average show that's on the Science Channel, mm-hmm. or the Discovery Channel,
right,
or the Learning Channel,
the Learning Channel,
the History Channel. There are a number of cable channels that ostensibly are dedicated to educational material, and most of that material is crap, or even just flagrant pseudoscience. I mean, they're just pandering to pseudoscience in order to, I guess, to goose ratings. But they should try to do that by how about just producing really good quality educational TV. You know, hopefully that, you know, if Cosmos is a really big financial and popular success, you know, hopefully it'll have some coattails. Hopefully they'll, you know, it'll inspire some TV executive somewhere to go, hey, maybe if we produce quality science programming, you know, we could get some viewers that way. Rather than just the crap that they're putting out, you know.
Think of the effort though, and the skills that went into creating Cosmos compared to the Jersey Shore, mm-hmm. for example. I mean, it's when you look at the bottom line, it's like it's kind of hard to really justify that. But I think that there's a sweet spot too. There's a lots of science shows on that kind of bridge the gap, try to make it entertaining but also educational. I just recently found one, and it has the best title ever: The Science of Stupid. Which is fantastic because it shows people all over the internet, of course, doing stupid stuff, but then they tell you the science behind it and where they went wrong. And I thought, what an awesome idea that is, you know, just try to throw some education. And we all love watching those videos. So merge those two. And I thought that was a really good idea. So we need more of those too.
Did you guys have a favorite episode?
I like the one when they showed future technology. That was cool. Although they got it wrong.
I did like all the episodes, but I do think that the episode 6, Deeper, Deeper, Deeper Still, mm-hmm. was one of the best written. It really flowed very well.
Steve, you sure that wasn't a porn?
I'm sure somebody's already working on the porn version of Cosmos right now.
I liked Unafraid of the Dark, the finale, quite a bit. That one certainly stood out. And also, I liked Sisters of the Sun, episode 8. I think perhaps I learned from all of them, but I learned quite a bit from that one, a lot of things that I hadn't known before. So that one captured me a little more than some of the other ones and some of the other stories I was more familiar with. So that one, because it had the most, I think, new material for me, that one caught my interest.
Yeah, that was a good one. I liked the last episode, of course. I thought it ended the series very well. And I liked the whole, you know, the ship of the imagination and, you know, science and learning as a journey. And then at the end, you know, you see the ship of the imagination
with the seat empty.
Excellent.
It's your ship now, mm-hmm. you know?
Just a note, I was looking up ratings for Cosmos, and it's got okay ratings by and large over the course of the series, but nothing spectacular. And for its last, basically it tied the Bachelorette, which is its like big competition, I guess. That said, you know, it's on Fox, which has way fewer viewers in general than ABC, where Bachelorette is. But at the same time, yeah, if you're looking at it in terms of pure numbers, reality shows cost nothing to produce mm-hmm. compared to something like Cosmos. So yeah, it didn't do well enough that we could say like, oh, this is definitely going to spawn a bunch of more cool documentaries.
It was an ambitious time slot. 9 o'clock on a Sunday night is, you know, there's lots of stuff out there for people to watch. There's a lot of competition.
TiVo. Well, the whole thing.
Sure. As did I, of course.
A show like that will also have more life than a reality TV show like The Bachelorette.
Oh, my God, yes.
It's the kind of show like, yeah, definitely I'm going to go back and watch those episodes two or three times.
Yeah, and it is the sort of thing that I could see more people buying on Blu-ray than something like The Bachelorette.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Rebecca, question for you. Do you think they did a good job? I thought they did a fair job of showcasing some of the female scientists that we need to know about more about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
That's where the original Cosmos, didn't have any episodes that really focused on anything like that. And I'm not criticizing the original in that context, but that's one of the things that was so different, refreshing, and, you know, you learn so much new in this new Cosmos series.
Yeah, no, it was very clear that they went out of their way to, highlight some otherwise overlooked, female astronomers. Yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, their contributions were fabulous. And Neil even said, you've never heard of these scientists. I mm-hmm. wonder why.
Yeah.
You know, why yeah. would, you know, yeah, exactly. It's not because their contributions weren't worthy. All right. Well, yeah, the bottom line is I think we all agree that it was a great series. And, you know, anything that increases interest in science, scientific literacy is wonderful. Let's move on to some news items. Have you guys all seen Deepak Chopra's challenge to skeptics?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I take this very seriously, Steve.
Sorry.
Do you?
I had to get that out of my system.
No,
I don't.
You want that $1 million, huh?
He has a challenge to quote unquote Randy and his cronies. So I guess we're Randy's cronies.
All right.
I'm all right with that.
Well, the point is, I mean, all right. So Deepak
I feel
like has
I need
been
a baseball
getting.
Bat.
Yeah, he's been getting very uppity about skeptics in the last couple of years. Like, we're clearly getting under his skin, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's been taking pot shots at us, you know, multiple times. This is just the latest one. And yet he doesn't seem to know the first thing about skepticism or the skeptical movement, you know? Like, he knows Randy and a couple of other famous names, and he somehow thinks like, I don't know, we're all just following Randy around or something. It's like, no, it's actually quite a big community with lots of people and scientists and philosophers, et cetera. You know what I mean? He really has no idea what we're all about, clearly. So his challenge, which is he's not the first person to offer a fake challenge, sort of mocking Randy's, you know, the JREF's $1 million psychic challenge. Mm-hmm. So all you have to do, so Deepak Chopra will give you $1 million. All you have to do is, in one peer-reviewed paper, advance neuroscience about a century mm-hmm. and solve the hardest problem of the philosophy of science that exists.
Oh, is that all?
That's it.
All
right. One paper. If you could do that, then he'll give you $1 million. But he's not...
That wouldn't be enough.
Yeah, the thing is...
You did it.
He didn't... He actually hasn't established any clear criteria, so it's just... It's fuzzy. So even if you did do that, he could say, meh... Meh, not quite enough. So this is what he wants you to do. He says, this is an exact quote now from the video. Dear Randy, before you go around debunking the so-called paranormal, please explain the so-called normal. How does the electricity going into the brain become the experience of a three-dimensional world in space and time? If you can explain that, then you get $1 million from me. Explain and solve the hard problem of consciousness in a peer-reviewed journal. Offer a theory that is falsifiable and you get the prize. The hard problem of consciousness is something that philosophers of mind talk about. The easy problem
is figuring out like how the brain processes images and sound and moves your muscles, you know, all the little things that the brain does. The hard problem is qualia, is why do we experience our own existence? The subjective experience of our stream of consciousness. Philosophers don't even agree that there is a hard problem, you know, let alone solving it. I personally, you know, agree with Daniel Dennett, who says that once you've solved all the easy problems, you have solved the hard problem. It is just, you know, it's just what you get when you add all the easy problems together. You know, just our subjective experience is just experiencing all of the processing, you know, with the processing that the brain is doing.
It's an emergent phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd like to turn this around 180 degrees and say to Chopra, like, prove anything that you've ever said.
Yeah, right.
Any one thing, just pick one.
Oh my gosh, just
it could it could be like you could say right now the sky is blue and then prove it. Like I would that would impress me.
Yeah, so the thing is like he's talking about proof in science and he doesn't give any criteria. Explain it. What does explain mean? Explain it to what depth of reductionism are you looking for here? I can explain it right now, you know, on some level. In terms of neuronal firing and neurocorrelates, neuroanatomical correlates, and although he says he won't accept the neuroanatomical correlates as evidence. You know why? Because that's evidence we already have, right?
Because you'd be out $1 million.
To be out $1 million, right. So forget all the evidence that already exists. I want some ill-defined other evidence, and I'll let you know whatever that is.
Oh, got to the gaps.
It's an absolutely. It's his dualism of the gaps approach. You know,
the problem is, Steve, you would have to explain it to such a degree that you would convince him that there's no magic involved and that is not going to happen.
You know, and the glaring reality here is that if you do a deep dive on Randy's $1 million challenge, there are rules. A lot of things are agreed upon between the person being tested and the testers. There is an actual visible goal that you need to get to. Everything is agreed upon in advance. I mean, with this complete BS $1 million challenge that Chopra's putting up, it's basically him just thumbing his nose at us because no $1 million will ever be paid out. There is no way to actually achieve it.
Yeah, it's a farce. You're right, Jay. With Randy's challenge, it's first of all, the challenge is for somebody to do what they already claim they could do. Not something new. Say you saying you could do X, okay, just do it. Do X, do what you claim you can already do under these conditions to this level to this very specific outcome. That's all.
And do you agree? Yes. Okay, we'll move forward.
Yeah.
And they agree to it. They agree to it.
So in this case, Chopra wants you to explain neuroscience to an arbitrary level of detail that he doesn't even begin to explain what that would be. The other thing that he goes into in the video, which is something that he has done before and other dualists have done this, is to say that intention is evidence that the mind is operating without the brain.
Right.
Yeah, right? It doesn't make any sense. So he says that
I'm convinced.
Like if I ask you to think of a sunset, you think of a sunset and then that triggers, you know, the firing of neurons in your brain. But the thought comes first. Where does the thought come from?
From his suggestion?
Yeah. I mean, it comes from your brain.
Yeah.
It's a brain heard you, you know, my brain hears you say, think of a sunset. And then that my brain communicates with itself, you know, that triggers an internal conversation going on that's also fed by external stimuli. It's a continuous loop of activity. There's also now we have copious amounts of research showing that before you can communicate that you experience something or act upon some initiative, there are firings going on in the brain, you know, previous to that. You know, the brain firing happens first before intention or subjective experience or anything else. That's been clearly established now.
And that would blow away everything you're talking about, Steve, if it was the opposite. If it were the opposite, it would be like, oh boy, that's like finding, you know, a chihuahua, you know, in a, next to a T-Rex. I mean, that would kind of be kind of weird.
It would be a mystery. Everything. Yeah, it would be an anomaly. It'd be a mystery. But no, it's, you know, it pretty much shows the brain activity is what comes first. I mean, the arrow of cause and effect is so clearly established from brain to mind. In fact, the mind isn't even a thing caused by the brain. The mind is the brain. It's just the functioning of the brain. That's what it is. It's definitely, that's the only conclusion that you can come to based upon all of the neuroscientific evidence that we have. But in people who criticize that, and I've written about this 100 times on Neurologica, I've engaged in, you know, that many comment, you know, duels. And, you know, the people who don't accept that, by and large, are grossly ignorant of the state of neuroscientific research. There's no other way to say it. They just have no idea how much neuroscientists have explored the relationship between the functioning of the brain and mental experience. The link is so clearly established, and not just a correlation, but everything that should flow from the mind being the function of the brain is there.
Yeah, Steve, I really liked your analogy in your blog post that if you asked somebody 100 years ago to describe the functioning of the brain to the level that we know it now, they wouldn't be able to do it, and that would, you know, people would think that would be a strong argument, but it's not.
Yeah, so yeah, my point was that like a Deepak Chopra of the 19th century would say, "Oh yeah, show me the neuroanatomical correlates, and show me this and that, and show me all the stuff that now we take for granted." And so Chopra is just the God of the Gaps style is just saying, "Oh yeah, show me something that, you know, we're not going to really be able to prove for 100 years, and then I'll accept it." And then I'm sure 100 years from now, that, you know, whatever the version of Deepak Chopra that's around in the 22nd century will be asking for something that we don't have at that time. You know, sure, we have artificially intelligent computers,
and then AI will just jack him into the mainframe, right. And he'd be like, "Oh, okay. I was wrong."
Steve, in your opinion,
Do
you think Chopra is a believer?
I think so, but that it doesn't really matter what I think. I mean, it's because who really knows? I can't read his mind. He certainly acts like a believer. I think people like him who are making millions of dollars off of selling pseudoscience, it's some combination, you know, of they know that they're cutting corners. They're engaged probably in a lot of motivated reasoning.
Oh my God. And rationalization.
Yeah.
You're talking mega giga rationalization that we all know the human mind is capable of.
Well, if only he had a forum to come on and, you know, talk and further express his opinions. If only we could invite
free T-shirt,
him.
Free T-shirt.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That'd get him on.
Yeah. I on my blog, I publicly challenged him to come to TAM to find out what skeptics really say.
And we'll much like Ann Coulter, cricket.
Yeah, Coulter never took my challenge.
Yeah, what the hell? Come on.
Shocked.
It's possible she never heard it, but still.
Hey, you think?
All right, well, Bob, apparently Hewlett-Packard is teasing us with some brand new computer architecture. Tell us what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah. This was actually fun to research. As Steve said, HP announced recently, and this was in Vegas, a completely new architecture that they're designing and developing called The Machine that could possibly, perhaps, maybe be worthy of the word revolution.
Bob, that was invented in the 70s. Remember La Machine?
Yeah, I was thinking that, Jay.
La Machine.
I was thinking La Machine.
What is La Machine?
It was like one of the first food processors.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so it's fitting though that this latest announcement took place in Vegas, because HP is certainly,
you know, when they say "la," it's French, you know, it makes it sound better, Rebecca. It's
cool. No, I get it. Yeah. I'm excited. Yeah.
Sorry, Bob.
It's all right. HP certainly seems to be betting the house on this technology. They even use the term "doubling down" during one of their talks. So let's just talk about the name. Come on. The Machine. Seriously, guys. You know,
it's like a professional wrestler's name.
It's pathetic. You know, they said
the
that
machine.
They were,
yeah. You know,
they couldn't think of the name. So they said they started calling it The Machine, and marketing was trying to think of a cool name, and then it just stuck. And then, of course, that's it. We're stuck with The Machine. Hello. Mm.
It's good to hear though that they have as much trouble coming up with marketing names as we do.
Right.
And they're a big company.
I understand.
Because we were thinking about calling our show Podcast.
Yeah.
The podcast.
So, but what their point though was that this isn't a computer. This isn't a server. It's not a mainframe. It's not a laptop. It's all of those essentially. So the bottom line then, why do they think this new architecture is so special? And the number one reason, the biggest reason, has all to do with memory, computer memory. I'm sure almost everybody's aware computers essentially have two different kinds of memory. That you've got RAM, random access memory. It could be, you know, there's lots of flavors of that. And then there's also hard drive memory as well. A RAM and its variants are fast as hell, but they're small, right? They're relatively tiny.
It's part of the processor, not part of the processor, but it's part of your computer where that's like where your brain is doing a lot of its memory juggling and thinking. It's not storage. It's just intended for the operation of the machine.
Yeah, it's working memory.
Right. It's manipulating it, and it's doing it at tremendous speed. But the thing is, though, it's volatile, meaning that once the power's off, the data goes bye-bye. It's not there. Huge, huge disadvantage for memory like that. Hard drive space, on the other hand, as we all know, is the opposite. It's slow. It's relatively slow, but it's huge. In terabytes, we're all sitting right next to machines filled with terabytes, which 10, 15 years ago would seem amazing. But it's just cavernous. But slow, as I said. So the machine consolidates into one memory. All of this called universal memory. And so this has the best of both worlds. It's really fast and gargantuan at the same time. And it's non-volatile. So when you turn it off, turn it back on, it's all right there. And they're talking, you know, hundreds of petabytes. But the real elephant in this server room is how they're pulling this off. And it's memristors. This is the new technology. It was theorized decades ago. It was actually mathematically deduced that memristors should exist. And a memristor is actually a fundamental element of simple circuits, along with inductors, resistors, and capacitors. It's fundamental, but it can be used as memory as well. So as a memory device, this seems like the holy grail. It could really, really remove a tremendous bottleneck found in all conventional computers, because what they seem to be spending most of their time doing, and I think it's like 80 or 90% is one figure I found, they're essentially shuffling data, you know, from long-term storage to short-term storage so that they can manipulate it. And it just takes an inordinate amount of computer time to do all that. And if you can get rid of it, if all your memory is right there next to the cores to access immediately, then that's a huge, huge plus. Amazing, amazing plus. It's a game changer. Okay.
Do you know how they're doing it? Are they using?
Yeah. Well, the memristors. There's a mesh of wires that meets the other wire going in the other direction. If you send a current and you apply these special materials to it, if you send a current through it, it'll change it. It'll change it like essentially to a one or a zero. And then when the current's gone, it's going to remember that. So that's a very, very high level description of what memristors are. If they can get that to work, that is literally one of the holy grails.
What do you mean, if
computer technology?
Are we talking that have this, or is this thing like?
I was going to cover that at the end, Jay. How realistic is this? I mean, they've been working on it. I'm sure they've got some nice prototypes, but is it ready? You know, I'll go into a little bit more detail. But
what do you think about 5-10 years?
That's funny. So memory is one of the big reasons why this is going to be revolutionary. The other reason, the other primary reason, is data transfer. It's no longer going to be ruled by electrons moving through copper wire. In the machine, the electrical interconnects that all computers use now will be replaced by these very slick, very fast optical ones, optical interconnects. No copper wire, no electrons, all photons. So, of course, it's going to be a hell of a lot faster, and maybe even more importantly, it's going to greatly, greatly reduce costs, perhaps by 80%, or perhaps it's to 1/80th. It's actually kind of odd that Martin Fink was saying that it's going to be 80 times less expensive, and which is an odd way to put it, don't you think? I'm not sure. Did he mean 80% less expensive, or literally 1/80th, which would be even better. Regardless, though, it's going to be a tremendous, tremendous power and money saver. It's going to save millions and millions of dollars if it works, of course.
But it has to be made out of solid diamond.
Yeah, right.
It's the only drawback.
People have asked me about it, and from what they're saying, the cost of these. I mean, you could make these with conventional, you know, with conventional manufacturing technology. So that's huge. None of this technology is ready for prime time. It's not even really on their plans to make. This is stuff they're still working on. It's still in the laboratory, especially memristor technology. HP plans for it and the machine itself to be ready between 2017 and 2020. There you go, right there. That's when they planned. So it's going to be, that's close though. That's coming.
Yeah, you're saying 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. But okay. The thing is, though,
why did we could have stopped this whole thing like 20 minutes ago when Steve said that.
Oh, I know, but you would have missed all
this Rebecca,
cool that
shit. Those years are 80% like less far away than other years.
You shot who in the what now?
I was using the 80% from before.
Jasper! The 80%. I love Jasper.
So I think the odds are against these guys. It's, you know, this is vaporware right now. I mean, it doesn't exist now, and they're talking about it. Sure, we need this technology, but memristors might not even be workable. You know, these plans can fail for a host of reasons. I hope it works, but it could easily fail, and this revolution will be over even before it even starts.
You're saying this is the hydrogen economy of computing?
Bob, I agree that, of course, companies need to be spending money and putting a lot of energy into things like this, but I really do question the motivation behind putting out this news item.
Jay, it's fundraising, getting investors, creating a buzz.
Okay, yeah, that's why I want to know. I mean, part of it is for people like us, the street people who are you know, drooling at technology like this, it really just is a series of disappointments for us. You know, it's always the next cool thing that we've talked about. And then they never come around. You know, we've been doing this.
Well, Jay, I wouldn't say never. So I think the history really has been that we get promised all these cool stuff, and some of them never materialize, but some do. But those that do are about a decade behind when the buzz is generated. So like we might see this at 2030, you know, instead of 2020 or something like it. Cause yeah, we have, as we mentioned before, our cell phones that we have today are better than what we were drooling over in the 1980s, you know, about, or 1990s, about what was coming, what we were promised. You know, it just took a decade longer than what we were led to believe, but it actually did eventually exceed our expectations, you know? All right. So we'll revisit this in 5 years, Bob, right? Keep track of that.
Okie dokie.
Rebecca, you wrote a blog post and a video here. The title is very interesting. Claire McCaskill skewers Dr. Oz.
This was epic.
Yeah, it was pretty entertaining, you guys. About a week and a half ago or so, people caught on to the news that Dr. Oz, America's doctor, we're all very familiar with him here, was going to testify before a congressional panel on weight loss consumer fraud. This is specifically a panel that is focused on all types of consumer fraud, but they decided to have this one session specifically about weight loss fraud. And so they invited Dr. Oz to come testify. Now, I saw a number of skeptics expressing concern about this, like this sort of letting the fox into the hen house kind of thing. But when I checked out the press release on the website of Claire McCaskill, who leads this panel, I was actually really impressed because they wrote that they were going to have Dr. Oz come and testify, and that Dr. Oz had previously promoted these this green coffee bean diet. And no, it's actually green coffee beans.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Oz was promoting it as this miracle weight loss cure. And just a few weeks after he promoted it, a company had been set up and was charging exorbitant prices for a little bit of this extract that they said, Dr. Oz, you know, swears by it. Dr. Oz says it's a miracle cure.
And Dr. Oz was shocked to see people exploiting his calling it a miracle weight loss cure.
Right. Yeah, his, right. His quote unquote
first time he's ever
flowery
expressed that,
yeah. Language.
Flowery. Yeah.
So this company, was set up and was basically ripping people off, so much so that the FTC stepped in and is currently suing them. So Ms. McCaskill's, press release states all this. So, to me, it was pretty obvious that they were calling Oz in to rough him up a bit, but it not only wasn't that clear to other skeptics, but it also apparently wasn't clear to Dr. Oz. It happened on Tuesday, the 17th of June, and it almost immediately the video went up online. C-SPAN put up the video, so you can still watch it if you go to C-SPAN's website. That might be U.S. only. I'm not sure. So what ended up happening was, yeah, McCaskill drilled Dr. Oz on this. She asked him, here's some quotes. Why would you say something is a miracle in a bottle? I'm concerned that you're melding medical advice, news, and entertainment in a way that harms consumers. The scientific community is almost monolithically against you in terms of the efficacy of the three products you called miracles. Because this was about both they mentioned the coffee beans, and there were also two other miracle weight loss cures. And McCaskill wasn't the only one. Other senators jumped in, like Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. She said, it's a major problem when people are spending more and more money and they're gaining more and more weight. Either you don't talk about these things at all, or you're going to have to be more specific, because right now this is not working. The whole thing is great. It's an hour and a half long. Feel free to check it out. There's a lot of great quotes. But yeah, they basically didn't back down. And Dr. Oz seemed actually taken off guard. And I read somewhere, I think ORAC posted a rumor that Dr. Oz actually was blindsided. According to the New York Daily News, who writes, a production source close to the 54-year-old cardiologist said he was perplexed. We were invited down to Washington to testify at a hearing about scams, and instead it became all about how much we hate your show, the source told the Daily News. Dr. Oz tried to sort of weakly defend himself in a number of ways. One thing he said was that he really does believe in these supplements. He did say outright that, yes, the science is against him, but he said that he recommends this to family, and if he can recommend it to family, he feels like he should recommend it to his audience. And then he also said in his defense that he's not personally selling any of the supplements himself, so he should be forgiven for using this, what he called flowery language. He talked about how, it's just the nature of television and how he interacts with his audience is that he has to be over the top and really promote these things. And so that's why he's using this hyperbolic language like miracle. The panel wasn't buying it, and they called him out on giving people false hope for these weight loss cures. So overall, it was really good. It only just happened as of this recording, so I don't know if anything's going to come of this panel. I'm certainly hoping that they come out with some sort of guidelines or, I don't know, some way to hold people like Dr. Oz accountable. It's clear that they weren't impressed with Dr. Oz. So whatever comes of this panel will be on the side of skeptics. Whether or not it actually goes far enough to really have any impact on what Dr. Oz and others like him are doing, it's too soon to say.
Yeah, basically we need regulation to rein in the supplement industry. That's basically what this is all about. Such legislation has been proposed before. It gets nowhere. So maybe this, could turn the tide a little bit politically towards protecting the consumer from these kinds of scams.
Guys, you missed it. I mean, from what I read, some senator actually used the word science-based medicine.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I saw ORAC wrote about that, and I think it is great. I think ORAC is a little too optimistic that skeptics sort of force this issue. McCaskill, I think, has been really obviously openly skeptical and good at checking her sources. But, there was a big push on behalf of skeptics. A number of us asked our audiences, hey, go to McCaskill's website and let her know what Dr. Oz has been up to. And I have no doubt that if there was anything in there that she hadn't seen before, I'm sure she read it, because she certainly came across as being very familiar with his brand of scams. And yeah, she did. She said science-based medicine. And yeah, I think it's really clear that McCaskill is a skeptic. And, being the head of a panel on consumer protection. It makes perfect sense, but it's so rare to see a politician actually leading up a committee that mm-hmm. they are appropriate for that I guess yeah. it's a right? little surprising, but it's a nice surprise.
I was shocked when I read that, and because clearly no senator is just going to pull science-based medicine out of their butt. They and from what I read, it's somebody said something about sending them some blogs, Steve, some of your blogs from science-based medicine. It's something about that. So I mean, that's fantastic. How incredible is that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can't conclude that we forced the issue or changed the way things went down, but clearly McCaskill and her staff probably were using the science-based medicine blog as a resource.
Yes, yes.
There's no other reason why she would use the term science-based medicine if she didn't read it.
Yeah.
And I invented the term. It's the name of my blog. And she also, we wrote articles about all the crap that Dr. Oz has been promoting, and they were going down our jot list, you know, yeah. point by point. So clearly, they were using our blog as a resource.
Yeah. It's not surprising. Shop. Absolutely.
It's not surprising. If you search on it on Google, our site comes up on the first page almost always. We have very good Google juice at Science Based Medicine. So I'm not surprised.
That makes it sound filthy.
Good for you, Steve, and good for all the other people that blog at Science Based Medicine.
Here.
Yeah. This is definitely a win.
Victory.
But we'll keep on top of it and report, see where it goes. All right, Jay. Well, as our resident tooth hygiene obsessed rogue, you're going to tell us about a new technology that will be available in 5 to 10 years for tooth decay.
Tooth decay. Yeah, here we go. So most people out there have one or more holes in their head, right?
I hope so.
Not the ones you breathe and eat out of. What I mean is that people have had a dentist drill out a cavity at some point. Some people are lucky enough to not have had to have gone through that one or more times. But a lot of us have had rotting parts of our teeth drilled out and filled in with some type of thing that sticks or binds to our teeth. And eventually that becomes horribly discolored and we have to get it removed and put back in. So the bad thing about fillings is that they don't last forever. And they do need, you know, a lot of times they do need to be replaced. And sometimes when you have a filling removed, they have to drill out the filling and they, you know, not deliberately and are very careful about this, but they do tend to make the actual hole a tiny bit bigger every time they have to do it because they have to remove all of the old bonding material and put in new stuff. So part of your tooth gets removed a lot of times when they do this. It's not like they just kind of click it and it falls out. Like they have to get in there with the drill and drill it out like it's made out of, you know, tooth, but it isn't. So, good news, everyone. This is awesome. British scientists have found a way to force a bad tooth to fix itself. So all those, you know, British actors with busted teeth can now rejoice.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Okay. Insulting a lot of people there.
The big book of British smiles. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Whoa.
No. So this method is called electrically accelerated and enhanced remineralization. And that was developed at King's College in London. The scientists are saying that it can reverse tooth decay by stimulating a tooth's own repair process. And your tooth, everybody's teeth, uses calcium and phosphate minerals to fix itself. And these are found in, you know, quite often in your saliva by food you eat. And with this treatment, the same healing process occurs, encouraging minerals to re-enter to the tooth. According to the researchers who developed the treatment, it could be ready in 3 years.
Ooh, less than
not five, not 10. Mm. They're saying 3 years. Anytime that they mention a number that's below five, I tend to think that they're already at the next level. Like they pretty much know it works and are just figuring out some minor details. I hope.
Or they're lying.
Yeah, that's true. They also say, however, that this treatment could be used to whiten teeth, which again, you know, that sounds like a big statement, but I can understand that if they're remineralizing your teeth, that it could bring back the whiteness because that's, you know, what the enamel of your teeth is made out of. They describe it as a two-step process. They first prepare the damaged enamel, and by preparing it, they dry it and they remove any kind of debris that's on your teeth that you can't even see, you know, because they want your whole tooth to be exposed. As a lot of, most of you know, the enamel is the outer layer of your tooth. And then they use a small electric current to make the tooth absorb minerals and repair the damaged area. So, like I said, your tooth already can do this, but the electrical current stimulates your tooth to do this more than it normally would. Right during when the current is applied. This process does not need any drilling. There's no filling materials and it's painless. They say that the electrical current is so weak that patients can't feel it. They feel nothing. Dentists already use electricity today, by the way, to check the health of your tooth, nerve, and pulp. So, you know, they're already using an electrical current for other stuff that's a lot more powerful. And, you know, maybe you can feel that, but you can't feel this new procedure. And it will be most effective against early stage lesions and moderate tooth decay. I don't think that they can fill, like, you know, your big cavity that you have on your front tooth, like Jim Carrey. Remember in Dumb and Dumber, he had his fake tooth removed, so he only had half a tooth for that movie. I don't think they could repair that kind of damage. I think it really is for like the very beginning stages of a cavity where you have a loss of enamel, and the under layer of tooth is being exposed, they can replace the enamel. So Nigel Pitts, who's from King's College Dental Institute, said, "The way we treat teeth today is not ideal. When we repair a tooth by putting in a filling, that tooth enters a cycle of drilling and refilling as ultimately each repair fails. Not only is our device kinder to the patient and better for their teeth, but it's expected to be at least as cost-effective as current dental treatments." Dental researchers were trying to find a treatment like this for decades, and they finally feel like they've achieved it. Now, do you guys know how a cavity starts and what a cavity actually is?
It's bacteria making acid.
Right. Well, it's basically the breakdown of food and sugars. It's turned into an acid in your mouth, and that acid eats away at your tooth's enamel. Now, typically, it's in like the crevices in your teeth or between your teeth where there's a lot of repeat action happening here. The food gets caught, it gets broken down, turns into acid, eats your enamel, and then every time you eat, it happens again and again and again. Now, your tooth can repair these spots by using the minerals found in your saliva and fluoride if it's present, and this is why you need to wash your teeth in fluoride, either toothpaste or a fluoride rinse. Or, you know, drink water that has fluoride in it, and it has to come in contact with your tooth, and your tooth will grab onto it and use it to repair itself. That's why we use fluoride. However, if you have repeat spots of acid on your teeth, you know, again, this is from, you know, either not cleaning your teeth often enough or properly, you're going to lose the battle like most of us have, and you finally, the enamel gets worn away, and this spot just takes a tiny little spot of enamel to go away, and then the base tooth is exposed, and then that starts to rot away. And these spots become the big cavities that the dentist at that point needs to drill out and fill in with some type of bonding agent. And then, you know, now you're past the curve there. So, you know, take good care of your teeth, and then, you know, in the future, if you get any new cavities, they can pull this device out and stimulate your tooth, and it'll repair it for you.
But you said it can't handle like a big cavity.
Well, it can't handle. I don't think it can handle a really big giant hole that's in your tooth.
You're saying it can't handle the tooth.
It can't handle the tooth. My God. Oh, yes, thank you, Steve. Wait, now hold on. Let me revel in that for a moment.
It's looking us in the eye the whole time.
And I've just turned the movie on in my head, and I watched him say it. Okay, thanks, Steve. That was awesome.
Excellent.
So. Yeah, I think that there is definitely an issue here with how big it can go, like how much of a problem it can solve. Of course, the very early stages, like when your dentist first finds that cavity, you're going at least once a year, right? You should be going twice a year. But if you're going to the dentist once a year, I'm sure that whatever they find, they can repair, unless you're just not brushing at all. But they can't repair like a gigantic gaping hole in your tooth. That's when they have to bring in the bonding agent and drill out all the disease tissue and put in.
Yeah, it's just when you were quoting the researcher, I think, and what they plan for this to be used for, it sounded less impressive than cavities. It sounded more like slight beginnings of, you know, a problem.
Yeah, I actually did look. I wanted to know to what degree they can replace the enamel. I think they can replace a hole in your enamel, but it can't be huge.
Well, we'll say it's still theoretical technology.
Three years.
We'll see. All right, you got to keep track of that one, Jay.
My news item beats Bob's. Thank you.
Set one of those reminder emails. Those like future emails. To email.
Yeah. Check. Like, check future about mail. Tooth decay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Jay. Evan.
Yo.
It's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thanks, Steve. You're right. And we'll go ahead and play for you right now last week's Who's That Noisy? And here she is in all of her glory.
I don't eat anything that's, you know, junk food, like processed, horrible chemicals. And I try to eat as organically as possible.
Chemicals are horrible.
Yes, they're, I know. Don't eat any chemicals ever. So a lot of folks thought that was our friend the food babe.
No.
No, not a bad guess. Not a bad guess. But nope. It's our friend and famous actress who is all about the elimination diet, if you've ever heard her talk about that. Gwyneth Paltrow, celebrity, singer, actress, tap dancer, fan of cupping, fan of detoxing, fan of belief that water has feelings, cleansings, anti-gluten, you name it. She's doing it in the world of anti-science. Yay, Gwyneth.
She's a talented actress, and she should stick with that.
Right. Shut up and act.
But Steve, her fame and popularity, of course, means that what she thinks and says is correct, no?
Yeah, somebody told me, an actor, I don't know if I should mention his name, but said that the culture in Hollywood is such that, like, if you're making a movie, there's a pecking order, and it's based purely on fame. You know, like, the most famous actor is at the top of the pecking order. And in all things, their opinion holds sway over anyone below them in the pecking order based upon fame. So fame equals authority in the world of Hollywood, according to this Hollywood actor.
Interesting.
Wow. Yeah. That's a dangerous society to live within.
Yeah.
Very dangerous. You're not going to last long there. That's for sure.
It's really difficult to be a critical thinker in that environment, I'm sure.
There seems to be a lot of evidence for that. Yes.
Yep. So Gwyneth does not disappoint when it comes to promoting pseudoscience. So well done, Gwyneth. Lots of correct answers, lots of correct guesses from listeners all over the place. But this week's winner of the contest is Josh Weed. Well done. Your name is
Josh Whedon.
Josh Weed?
Yes. Josh and I go way back.
God, I hope he can come on the show. I hope he wins the raffle.
I convinced him.
If it's Josh, he will win.
Look at that. Josh Whedon won.
Josh Whedon. Hey.
What are the chances? Hey,
Josh, come on the show. Collect your prize.
And he'll win every year from now on. He's not even entering, but he's winning.
Well done, Josh. Congratulations. Now on to the brand new Who's That Noisy? So last week's was a female voice. This week we have a male voice. Let's see. Let's see if you guys can decipher this one. Let's see what we got here.
But my principal thoughts are that I should extend, if I can, that knowledge which I have on psychic matters and spread it as far as I can to those who have been less fortunate.
A pompous British psychic from the 19th century.
He definitely sounds like he has a mustache.
Awesome. You could hear it through those whiskers.
I can hear it.
Through
yeah.
that brushy upper lip stuff.
Yeah, it's that walrusy kind of lilt.
Walrusy.
Yeah, that's a good description.
Our pal Fred Bremer actually sent this one in. So,
yo, Fred.
Thanks, Fred. I really appreciate that. It's a really good clip, and I think our listeners are going to enjoy guessing this one.
I love that guy.
Everybody loves that guy.
Who doesn't?
He's second tallest skeptic I know.
And we all look
and
up
the
to him.
First most lovable.
Okay, so give us your guess. WTN at theskepticsguide.org or the forums. We have a sub-forum called Who's That Noisy? Check it out there, and you can post your answer there as well. And our forums domain is sguforums.com. Before I say good luck to everyone, I would like to credit listener Kyle Baumgardner for 2 weeks ago sending in that those otters playing the keyboard. He was the one who shared that with me initially, so I wanted to give Kyle some credit there.
Good luck, everyone.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, guys. We have time, I believe.
Time.
For one question this week. This one comes from Paul Lamar from the United States, and Paul writes, I saw this graphic about solar energy on your Facebook page. Having a little experience with renewable electricity generation, this graphic seemed overly optimistic, so I dug into the numbers a bit more. Apparently, this graphic comes from a diploma thesis. On page 11, she takes 250 gigawatt hours per kilometer squared as an assumed base yield. This would work out to 250 kilowatt hours per meter squared, but according to Wikipedia, we only receive about 1 kilowatt per meter squared of energy at the surface of the Earth. Where are those extra 249 kilowatts per meter squared coming from? I then looked up numbers from an existing solar generation plant, the 354 megawatt SEGS solar complex in northern San Bernardino County, California. This plant can generate up to 354 megawatts, hence the 354 megawatt complex, but covers 1,600 acres or 6.475 kilometers squared. This suggests a yield of approximately 55 megawatts per kilowatt kilometer squared, or 0.055 kilowatts per meter squared. Jay, did you get all that? Am I making a silly mathematical mistake, or is this graphic in error by three orders of magnitude? What do you guys think? Did you catch Paul's silly mathematical mistake?
Yeah, I know it is now, but the graphic itself, though, they really should have been a little bit more explicit in terms of, you know, what are they talking about? Photovoltaics? Are they talking about solar concentrators? What kind of efficiency? So they could have been a little bit more explanation. But
so let's back up a little bit. For those who don't know, we've been much more active on the Skeptics Guide Facebook page. We're posting multiple posts every day, links to news items, as well as to blogs and, you know, lots of memes, trying to generate some more skeptical traffic. And one of a recent post that we put up a few days ago was just a picture of Northern Africa, and it had a little square that said, this is how big an area of the Sahara Desert you would need to cover with photovoltaics, or didn't we, guys? Bob said it wasn't really specific, in order to supply the electricity needs of the world. Then it had a smaller square for all of Europe and a smaller one still for just Germany. And then a lot of people, including Paul, took exception to that representation, saying no, that their back of the envelope calculations, that these was way overly optimistic, that you would need to cover a much greater area. And then, and Paul sent us the email basically expressing the same thing that a lot of commenters did on the Facebook page. But they're all making a mistake. And Paul makes it right here, and he does it right in the email. He says 250 gigawatt hours per kilometer squared. And then when he goes to the Wikipedia page in terms of how much sun we receive, he's talking about 1 kilowatt per meter squared. The hours isn't there. He's comparing kilowatt hours over the course of an entire year to just watts or kilowatts of peak energy at any one moment. So does that make sense?
Yep.
Now, if you have, you have 8,760 hours per year, and again, I looked this up multiple independent sources. I did all the calculations myself, but just let me focus on one specific point. 8,760 hours per year and roughly a 20% efficiency in terms of the number of hours per day that has sunlight on average per year and the number of days that have sun versus cloud cover, et cetera. And the couple of sites I looked at, you add that all up and you get to about a 20% efficiency in terms of just how much sun exposure you're getting. So 20% of around 9,000 hours, you're roughly 1,000. That's your three orders of magnitude right there. Right? We're doing what, Lawrence Krauss suggested, and we're just talking all in round numbers, just orders of magnitude.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's your three orders of magnitude. I also completed the calculation just to see what I would get. This was the figures I found were for the 2004 world annual electricity demand was 16,600 terawatt hours. So if you go through the calculation and you assume a solar cell efficiency of 10%, which is pretty reasonable, you end up needing an area about 100,000 square kilometers, which is 316 kilometers on one side. And that's exactly the size of the square in the Sahara that was on the graphic that we put on our Facebook page. So to first approximation using rounded off numbers, I think that that was exactly correct. And I tried to work it both ways. I tried to work it as many different ways as I could, and I kept coming up with the same answer. And I think that just the people who were saying that it was way off by orders of magnitude were confusing watts to watt hours over the course of a year.
Yeah. The other comments that I thought were kind of amusing, people were saying, why would you build, you know, why would you put all your yeah. solar concentrators in one, you know, in one country? That's so, you know, it's ridiculous and risky. Like, dude, the point is to show you how much space, not that we would necessarily or even could, you know, build it in one place. Which yeah. is silly.
I feel really bad for whoever did that dissertation to, like, I hope they never see this meme because I could just imagine seeing like some, like, you know, a lot of work probably went into that and it was one piece of a larger argument, and now it's been turned into a meme, and there are like 1,000 amateur scientists like debunking it. Yeah. Like that would infuriate me.
Yeah, Rebecca, I had a similar thought. You know, I was thinking this is from somebody's thesis, I believe, this figure it came from, apparently. And I'm thinking, wait, if they made a mistake by three orders of magnitude, not only did this graduate student miss it, but then all her supervisors and, you know, the people that vet, you know, yeah. her thesis, they would have missed that too. I was very skeptical just from that fact alone.
But it is interesting. A couple of things here are maybe worth a little bit further discussion. One is that, you know, we're using Facebook for outreach, which means we're getting to beyond our listening audience.
Oh my God. I love you listeners. I love you guys.
And the comments are amazing. I mean, so now we're getting comments from just your average Facebook goer, not necessarily a skeptic or
yeah.
a science enthusiast. And the kind of stuff people are throwing out there are just unbelievable. It is mind boggling. But in here, like Bob, you're right. The funny, and it seems like, I think what's happening is that a lot of times people are just getting the image in their own Facebook feed. And they're not like reading the articles we're attaching to. And they're
just coming up with their own things.
They're completely misinterpreting what the whole thing is about. You know, like, this is just one example. Like, they're saying, yeah, where are you going to store? How are you going to transmit all that energy around the world? It's like, dude, no, so they're not, it's just putting it all in one space just to show you how big it would be.
Yeah.
But there are serious, proposals to like break this up obviously into like 40 different solar farms, you know, in the deserts around the world, Australia, China, Africa, South America, you know, the Western United States, etc. And, you know, obviously distribute it as much as possible. And, you know, it certainly could take up a huge chunk of the electricity that we need. You know, we could generate a lot of it building solar panels with current technology. It would be cost effective if you put it in the right place, but you know, peak energies during the day anyway, when you know, this would be generating it. Obviously we would need other ways of generating electricity when the sun isn't shining.
Or a way to store it.
But you know, that's yeah. a way to store it is new technology. So we don't really have an off the shelf existing technology right now where we could store that much power. So if we just assume current existing technology.
Yeah.
This would be good to just offset peak production. We would still need to have nuclear power plants or whatever to generate electricity at other times.
Yeah, Steve, real quick, back to the comments. I calculated an average. On average, every 9 comments, I say to myself silently, did you even read my post?
Yes, exactly. That's being a little generous, I think, too.
Yeah.
That's okay. Definitely, hey, traffic.
We need more skeptics in there balancing out the comments a little bit more, I think. Well, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. You guys ready for this week?
Always.
The solar panels in the desert is fiction. Ready.
Yes. Okay. There's a theme this week. The theme is water. It is water. Oh. You guys are familiar
clear
with
water.
Narrows
it's all
it
about
down.
Dry drowning.
We're familiar with water, right? Okay. Gosh.
I love specifically listening for Rebecca's groan when Steve mentions the word theme.
Yes, I do too.
It's pretty consistent.
Amuse you.
We have somebody working on a mashup of all the groans Rebecca has made over the last year, putting it into one file.
You mean just in the podcast, right?
Yeah.
Well, too far.
It's all I know that we're recording, so.
Okay, here we go. Item number 1. The average American uses 80 to 100 gallons of water per day, mostly from flushing toilets. Item number 2, there are 19 known phases of ice. And item number three, a new analysis of the surface of Pluto's largest moon, Charon, and its orbit around Pluto concludes that it likely harbors liquid water beneath its surface. Jay, go first.
Okay, so the average American uses 80 to 100 gallons of water per day. Wow!
And to clarify, that's household use. That's not like counting all the water we use to grow food and stuff. That's just you're personally using that much water.
I mean, I know a couple of facts here about how much water a toilet tank carries, and it, whatever. I just can't imagine that we're using 100 gallons of up to 100 gallons of water a day. What else could it be? Cooking, cleaning, you know, I definitely do dishes every day, and I'm sure, you know, the water's running pretty much the whole time, but, you know, what, how many gallons of water could that possibly be? And drinking, you know, that doesn't turn into much. Okay, this next one, there are 19 known phases of ice. You know, like, I have to ask questions like, is this stuff in the ice? Like, if there's salt present or other minerals present?
No, just ice.
It's just your average water found on the planet. Just 19 phases.
Water, ice, not including other stuff. Yeah.
Okay. I was recently talking to Bob about if you have perfectly clean water, like literally no minerals in it whatsoever, it could go way below freezing and it won't crystallize. It needs something to crystallize on. That's interesting. I, you know, I'm trying to think about what some of the phases would be, and I can't think of really any that many. Yeah, I got two, okay. Water and ice. new analysis.
Ice? There's two phases of ice. Ice and not ice.
Not ice. Ice in my glass and ice in the refrigerator. All right, so this one, this final one, it says that there's liquid water beneath the icy surface of a Plutonian moon.
You just don't want to see that moon, Jay, do you? You don't want to say the name.
Charon?
I knew it. I knew it.
Never. Good call, Bob.
Wow, now a whole new level of pathetic behavior has arisen in my head, Bob. I actually avoid saying words I'm not sure about the pronunciation of. No! Okay, so I don't think there are 19 phases to ice. That's the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
All right, I've been trying to like puzzle over. I've been doing some math in my head here. I don't know anything about Charon. But I can believe that it harbors liquid water beneath its surface. I can also believe that there are 19 known phases of ice. You know, crackly. yeah, I mean, yeah, there are different ways that ice can form. And why not? I'm sure the Inuit have 19 different words for ice, so why not? So, okay, the average American uses 80 to 100 gallons of water per day. I'm thinking, like, I'm trying to picture my toilet tank, and I can't imagine that there's more than 4 gallons of water in there. And so, if most of the 80 to 100 gallons of water per day is coming from flushing toilets, it would mean that at least, like, 45 gallons of water have to be used with the toilet. Because that's most of 80 to 100. And so 4 into that is, you know, 11. So that means I would have to use the toilet. And I feel like 4 gallons is too many. I feel like I'm overestimating that. So that would mean at a minimum, I would have to use the toilet 10 times a day on average. There is no way I use the toilet 10 times a day. So, and I drink a lot of water. I drink nonstop throughout the day. So I pee a lot and I still don't think I use the toilet 10 times a day. So I'm going to say that that one's the fiction.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah, it was between the ice and the water. Charon, I could believe that I'm a little skeptical that they could be so confident that they could say likely. The other two are definitely more out there. The ice, yeah, I don't think it's different. I don't think it's 19 different types of molecular structure. But it's more of like how it formed, how much, you know, I don't know, humidity, whatever, to get these different forms or phases, of ice. I'm not sure I even like that word phases. I don't think that's a good word if I'm interpreting this right. But the water one just sounds way too high. I can't imagine. I wish I had a better handle how much the dishwasher uses, but still, if flushing is the most, I'll go with the water is fiction. Damn.
And Evan.
The theme is water, Paul.
The theme is water. Yeah, but what about the water?
Damn, I thought I'd get you.
Yeah, the water one.
gallons of water per day.
They covered all the bases here pretty much. So, 80 to 100 gallons of water per day. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. Mostly from flushing toilets. I had water efficient toilets installed in my house, and it has made a difference. I think it's you can definitely tell less water is used in those flushes. I think it's a good idea for everyone. 19 known phases of ice. Well, let's see. There's waxing gibbous, waning gibbous, waxing crescent. So I don't know if there's 19 of those.
He's making a joke.
Phases of the moon? Oh, phases of. Yeah, I'm thinking of ice. What does the ice have to do with the moon?
Well, speaking of which, Charon. Yeah, sure. Okay. Liquid water beneath its surface. We are doing new analyses of Pluto. Are we sending a probe there or something? Is it on its way? I can't remember. In any case, yeah, learning more about Pluto and its moons, certainly, I think that one's right. So, therefore, I'll put my nickel down, and I'm going to go with J, 19 known phases of ice, and welcome. I don't think so. It's either a lot more or a lot less.
All right, so we have an even split. We got Evan and Jay for the phases of ice, and Rebecca and Bob for the 80 to 100 gallons of water per day.
Start with Pluto, Steve.
You all agree, I always start with the one that you guys all agree with, you all agree that a new analysis of the surface of Pluto's largest moon, Charon, and its orbit around Pluto concludes that it likely harbors liquid water beneath its surface. You all think that one is science, and that one is the fiction.
What?
What?
Whoa. Wow. Steve, whoa. Oh, you bastards.
How dare
Slam
you?
Slam us. Wow.
So.
Likely. Wait, I don't want to read
the word
now.
Likely. Don't even bother reading them. Let's just move on.
All right, so.
That's what I get for not cheating.
You really suck, Steve, really? Like, hey, it has water down. No, there isn't any water. That is, get out of here. It's lame.
I do not go to the bathroom that much.
Well, we'll get there.
There are not 19 known phases.
So guys, Pluto, Charon, really far away from the sun. Very cold out there. Very cold out there.
Yeah,
you should have been skeptical of that one.
Yeah, not unless I've read the damn article.
I gotcha.
You bastard.
So, this is what the news item is, that scientists are trying to model, they're trying to pregame, because there is a probe on the way to Pluto, Evan. And
that's right.
So they want to, like, make use of the information, as best as they can. So what they're saying is that if there are cracks in the surface of the ice of Charon, then they should be able to tell by the size and thickness and structure of those cracks whether or not Charon ever had liquid water beneath the surface. Even if it did, though, it would be frozen by now.
What about tidal stresses?
Yeah, but the tidal stresses are gone. That's the point. That the Pluto and Charon are very close together, and they're very close in size. It's actually the closest.
They're tidally locked. Shit.
They're tidally locked. Of course, they're tidally locked. So that, which means there's none of that tidal stretching that would heat up the surface. But if there are big cracks in the surface of Charon, then that could mean that in the past, before they settled into their tidally locked orbit that they have now, that the tidal forces on Charon could have kept the interior hot enough to keep it liquid for a while. But now, because it's tidally locked, the stresses are gone. It would have frozen all the way through because it's really cold out there. So, yeah, and we haven't seen the cracks yet. This is just pre-gaming what's going to happen when the probe gets there. This is the New Horizons, right? New Horizons, which is going to get there, I don't know. When's it going to get there?
Mm-hmm. 5 to 10 years.
Pretty soon, actually. It's on the way. I don't know. But I think by the end of the decade, it's going to be there. So, yeah, that's pretty cool. But, yeah, no water now.
Wow.
So let's move on to the next one. I feel no guilt about that one.
Holy crap.
Let's go to number one.
You must feel a little guilty.
No, not at all. It was a perfectly fair one, and I got you. I'm happy. All right, number one. The average American uses 80 to 100 gallons of water per day, mostly from flushing toilets. I had to source this one from multiple sites because I never believe these kind of factoids. But I multiple sites agreed with this, including the U.S. Geological Survey. So I figured that's a pretty reasonable. It's a .gov. I figure .gov website should be believed. Maybe I'm naive. But they say each person uses 80 to 100 gallons of water per day, and that the largest single source of this is flushing the toilet. But here's the breakdown. You have to include water from taking showers and baths, teeth brushing, washing your face, washing your body, the dishwasher, or washing dishes by hand, washing clothes, flushing the toilet, drinking water, and outdoor watering. So this is the average person. Obviously, an individual may not do all of these things. Obviously, this is an average.
But more than 50... More than 40 to 50
single
gallons
source,
of water
though. Single source.
The greatest single, the largest single use is from flushing the toilet.
Could be 10 gallons.
Oh.
It's a plurality. Yeah.
Plurality.
Wow. More.
God damn it.
Yeah.
Well, that's, no, but that's not what your item says. Your item says mostly from flushing toilets. Mostly implies 40 to 50 gallons of 80 to 100 gallons.
Well, they say the largest use of household water is to flush the toilet.
I don't know. You could interpret that as
41 to.
I could see how you might 51. Consider that ambiguous. Although other sources, I did find other sources that did say it was mostly from water, which is why mostly from flushing toilets, which is why I said it that way. I'll have to check the other reference that I found.
All right.
Yeah, I will admit you have a point that could be interpreted that way. Although again, I was just quoting a source, so I'll double check that.
All right, I'll take it.
And there are 19 known phases of ice. That one, of course, is science.
Oh, of course. Everyone knows
it's,
that.
Water's a very interesting molecule.
Oh my God, yes.
Oxygen and hydrogen atoms can interact with each other in many different ways. So when you have ice in different temperatures and pressures, they form lots of different structures, you know? They form different kinds of crystals. Most of these, I think 16 of them, the source, again, I got a couple of sources on this. The best one that really lays it a lot, that says there are 16 or so crystalline phases. So they kind of hedged a little bit on the 16. And then there are three non-crystalline phases. So that's why I came up with 19. So the 19 may not be exactly accurate, but it's 19 or so, if you believe this source. Yeah, so there are three where it's not a
crystal. It's glassy, right?
Well, there's one that's glassy ice. There's like this viscous ice that's amorphic. It's not really crystalline. There's lots of different types of crystals like tetragonal, cubic, or orthorhombic, you know, so different crystal structures. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very interesting. So who knew that ice had so many forms? Yeah, there's this one called glassy ice where at certain temperatures and pressures, the ice is perfectly clear like glass.
Like a downside.
All right. Well, thanks for playing this week, everyone.
You're welcome, Steve.
You're welcome.
Well done, Steve.
Let's move on to something happy now.
All right. Yeah. Well, you have a happy quote for us?
Yeah, I have a cool quote. This is a quote sent in by a listener named Dan Cole, and he's from Los Angeles, California. The quote is, and let's see if you guys can guess who this is. "We establish no religion in this country. We command no worship. We mandate no belief. Nor will we ever. Church and state are and must remain separate."
Was that Thomas Jefferson?
That's a very good guess. And you're warm.
It's Jeffersonian. You're warm, but yeah.
I'll give you another couple of guesses.
Wink Martindale.
Is it Ronald Reagan?
Yes, it was Ronald Reagan.
40th President of the United States?
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. I just had a feeling.
That is interesting coming from the president who basically was responsible for the creation of the religious right in this country, or at least their rise to power within the Republican Party in the 1980s.
Well, it takes all sorts to raise the boat.
Well, I wonder what's the context of that quote, Jay? Did you get that?
Yeah, I did. I read the whole thing. He was talking about a law that was being passed in Connecticut having to do with not allowing people to pray at work.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying how it's our diversity here in the United States and our acceptance of that diversity that allows us to be what we are and be as successful and happy and live the lifestyle that we want. And he wanted Connecticut to reverse the decision that they made to not allow those people to pray.
Okay.
Wait, to not allow people to pray in the workplace?
He was saying he wanted people to be allowed to pray in the workplace.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Now that yeah.
Right.
It makes sense in that.
It does, but it's still a fantastically crafted sentence, and to me it's very powerful, and the sentiment of that sentence matches perfectly with my ideology.
Yeah, it's a good reminder. Too bad a lot of politicians don't exactly, you know, practice this
this very fundamental part of our founding, frankly. It's essential. And, yet you'd have a lot of politicians, foisting all sorts of religious stuff on us in all sorts of occasions. So it's refreshing.
Ronald Reagan!
Once again, a reminder that I'm going to be in Minneapolis for Convergence as part of SkepticCon, July 3rd through the 5th. You can go to skepticcon.com and see all of our various awesome speakers. And also on July 2nd, I'm going to be at the Bryant Lake Bowl in Minneapolis doing Quizotron.
I wanted to give a shout out for a podcast that I was recently on called The Atheist Nomads, atheistnomads.com. They interviewed me this past weekend on a Google Hangout. A lot of fun. Good questions, good times. Talked about a lot of different things. So thanks to both Dustin and Wesley for having me on.
And, of course, we have the amazing meeting coming up July 11th to 13th in Las Vegas. If you haven't registered yet, be sure to use the SGU TAM 2014 code when you register to get a $25 discount. Join us for the dinner. We'll have it be at the table selling swag. We're doing a live show. There's a poker tournament. We're having a special meeting just for our members. And we're going to be at Dragon Con in September, and we'll be in Australia in November and New Zealand in December. And we're really looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Yep.
Can't
wait. It's going to be a fun trip. And thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Good job, Dr.
Novella. Well done.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.